A note of clarification, or a couple of notes of clarification before I begin. I want to say that much of what I'm going to say today, I've said before here in other places. So if you've heard me on listening, you've probably heard quite a bit of what I'm going to tell you this afternoon. And I'm not as psyched up for this thing as I should be, because I'm a one-track guy, you know. And I'm reminded of my conversation with Paul Tournier this a month or so ago. I asked him, now that he's completed his book on aging and how, you know, and the problems and stuff of aging, what are you going to work on next? And he said, well, I have several ideas. I have three or four ideas. But, you know, it's like the man said, if you got three or four ideas, you don't have anything. You got to settle on one. And I'm kind of a one-track guy, and I've been sort of focusing in on this mystery bit. Now, that's kind of building up for tonight, you know, and you come in here and you say, oh, this is what he's been building up for, you know. But I'm really, you know, concentrating on that. So I'm just kind of shifting gears now because I'm frantic in there. In fact, Daryl came down. He says, "Well," I asked him what time the vespers were tonight, and he said 7:30. And you know, are you going to be ready? Going to be ready by 8, maybe? We should have it at 8. And I said, "Would you believe 10? You know?" Well, we'll do something. Like our friend Hans Enon in Richmond says, you know, we'll do something, even if it's wrong, but we'll do something. The other night, I said, you know, that isn't my bag, you know. And I want to explain that a bit, and I did explain it to the lady, that when I say something isn't my bag, it can mean quite a few things, but one of the things it means is that, you know, I don't know anything about it. really? And there may be several reasons for this. One thing that I'm a one-track guy, you know, there aren't too many things that I can, you know, consume and devour and get something out of it. But the other thing about it is it's a matter of priority. And we all must set our priorities as to what's important. I had this really impressed on me, for I spent a time as a guest of the Third Reich, as a prisoner of war. And for the first time in my life, I had some time on my hands, and I did a lot of thinking. And as the time wore on, and thinking back on my days in combat, and there were, the months went on into years, and it's a tough way to make a living. And I thought of these sort of wasted years and the allocation of time to us. And it sort of gave me a sense, a sense of purpose, but also a sense of this very limited time. One of our great gifts is time. But it has limits that we do not fully comprehend, or fortunately perhaps we do not realize how long they will be. But there is a sense of urgency. And realizing this sense of urgency, we must set priorities. And Matthew 10 says to me that we are here for two reasons: to proclaim and to heal. It isn't to proclaim or to heal, like many churches do, you know. The pietists on one side and the social action on the other. But it's to proclaim and to heal. And so you must evaluate what you do and what you spend your time at, I think, in terms of this mission. And the mission that I'm going to discuss now is that of listening. And this is in the field of healing, but it also is in the form of proclamation. I can recall people coming to me, not enough probably that I have helped, but some people have come to me and said, "You know, you really helped me out that time." And I couldn't even remember anything I had done for them. I couldn't remember any great advice I had given to them, and I'm very free with my advice. And the truth of the matter was, I probably gave them no advice at all, because they said, "You know, you listened to me. You listened to me." I recall again my visit last year with Paul Tournier, when some things were weighing very heavily upon me in our congregation. The firstborn child of a couple at 27 months of age drowned in the neighbor's pool. Just a little while before I talked to Paul Tournier in Geneva, I had a call from Dr. Gross. Now, I had never met Dr. Gross, but Karl Mao told him I was there and that I was working in cancer research. And so he called me up, and for 45 minutes he talked to me. And he told me about Karin, his middle child. Karin is the name of our middle child. Karin was 10. She developed swellings in the throat. It turned out to be leukemia. Is there any hope? And almost in desperation, I said to Paul Tournier, I asked Paul Tournier, "What do you tell people like that? What do you say to them?" And although he gave me quick answers to many questions, this one he didn't give a quick answer. He thought for a while and he said, "I do a lot of listening, for they must articulate this deep grief." So this is an important mission. The lament of every parent, every child, every husband, every wife, every teacher, every student is, "You have ears, but you do not hear," or "You don't listen to me." And that's a very big problem. The other day, an associate and a very good cancer research man who I share with another unit where he reports was very distraught because the person he works for there, he says, "I talk to him, but he doesn't really listen to me." You can sense this, you know. And it may be the cause for his leaving. Students, much of the unrest of the past several years is that there were a lot of administrators and a lot of teachers, professors, who never listened to the students. I had a letter from one here that I'll always remember, and I've had others. This girl was a graduate of the university. And she said, "You're the first professor I knew as a person." Well, that's a very terrible thing. So it's a very big problem. And many of those who have problems do not listen to you when you give them advice, but they must articulate it. And we have many misunderstandings in this regard. One of my favorite stories, and some of you who've heard it, I apologize ahead of time for it. It sort of points out the problem, and I'll hit quite a few of these as we go through this. Janet Wood was a neighbor of ours, and she was the only girl, and the other children were boys. And Janet was a very pretty girl. She was a beautiful girl, inner and outer beauty. And her mother kept a pretty close rein on her. This was some years ago. It's probably some of you don't recognize that now. But and she was now a senior, and she was going off to school. And a bit like our older daughter, she wanted to go a long ways away from home. And but she wisely selected a church school in the Midwest. And so she really be away for a while, and the parents thought, well, they hated to see her go too far, but since this was a good school, this was great. So she packed her bags, and she was ready to go. Father was waiting to take her to the airport, and so her mother had a little talk with her just before she left. And she says, now, Janet, when you get to this school, you're going to be meet a lot of boys, and many of them will ask you to go out with them, and that's fine. And as the fall wears off, you will probably settle on one, or maybe not that soon, but you might, and perhaps some evening, when the full moon is up, and you've been to a show or something, and he'll take you out in his car and go out somewhere, and he'll shut off the motor, and turn off the lights, and then he'll put his arm around you, and that's when your mother will start to worry. And with that, she took her leave. Now, she didn't come home at Thanksgiving, but she came home at Christmas. And you know how it is when the children come home for Christmas. Some of you do. It's a very great occasion. And they always, there was small talk, but it wasn't long before Janet found herself with her mother in the kitchen. She was helping her there, and there wasn't anybody else around. She says, Mother, it's just like you told me. And you gleaned from my letters. I had a lot of dates. And then as you realized, as the fall wore on, you heard I wrote quite a bit about Dan. Well, just the other night, after we had a party in the dorm, Dan took me out in his car. And it was a full moon. And he parked the car, and he turned off the lights, and he put his arm around me. And of course, her mother, wondered, well, what's going on now? And she says, but I remembered what you said. So I took his arm from around me, and I put my arm around him, and now I said, let your mother worry about you. Well, that isn't really what her mother had in mind, you see. And she really wasn't listening. We recognize this in my home and in our church, in the university community which I reside. And you recognize it in the buttons I wear, some of them in a way. I'm not understood, People wear buttons like this. Or, what's this one? Oh, that's Leo the Lion is a vegetarian. I am a human being. Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. No? They were like, I couldn't find my button that says, this button is just an attempt at communication. You know? So we've gotten to that. Well, on this art of listening, in studying it, we find that 98% of what we learn through our eyes and our ears. A survey showed that 70% of the day of a certain component of workers, 70% of their day was spent in communication. And looking at the breaking this down then, what part of time, what was the sort of division of this time as to the various forms of communication? And they found out that about 9% of it was spent in writing, 16% in reading, so 30% in speaking, and an overwhelming 40 to 45% in listening. Now, some of you husbands, maybe it's a different kind of a thing. It might be a different allocation or depending on your work situation. But generally speaking, there's a great component of our time that should be spent in listening. Yet if you analyze this, if I ask for a show of hands here today on how much of your curriculum has been spent or devoted to learning about the art of listening, there would be very few hands, because I do this. I ask some of our students, you know, well, have any of you had a course in comprehensive listening? Well, now it is being taught some places. In the early 50s, it was only taught in one place, and that was in a girls' college in the Midwest. It was taught as one of the social graces. And I know a couple of those girls, and they did well with it. Now, it's true, I mean, When you look at the reading and writing, many of us, you know, we've spent how many, 12, 16 years trying to learn how to do this. I mean, really intensive study. Or in speaking, we've spent, some of you, I took one course in it, I guess. And it's probably evident as I stumble along here, but there's more of them, more time now devoted to rhetoric, to speaking. But this emphasis on listening, we just assume, well, that's something you're born with. Yet that's a bunch of hogwash. Now, another thing that these people learned was that about a rather small percentage of what they heard, you know, they retained. You teachers recognize this if you've taught, you know. You give them a brilliant lecture, you know. Or if I tested you today on what I'm telling you, I'd be shocked. I would be shocked. And this is the experience of most teachers. They give a lecture and they find out that maybe an average of 50% of what they said kind of hung on for a little while. They wait a little while, they find out that it's down to 25%. This has been the experience of many people. They've actually done studies on this. There was a study I know at Columbia, and these were good students in the psychology class, and they'd brought in some very good lectures, and he then had them write a reasonable exam, and he tested them right after the exam, and then he waited a while. And he found out that on the average, a short time after the lecture, there's only 50% retention. And then if you wait a little while, or he waited a couple of months, it's down to 25% or less. And in this regard, I was interested in something my brother was reading, The Management of Time. And there was something in here. It says, look at the chain of information losses that accumulates in even a short conversation. You miss most of what is going on when you make your initial observation. You leave most of what you did see when you give your description to your listener. Often you unknowingly leave out some critical elements of the happening. Your listener only hears part of what you say. In loss four, your listener can only describe part of what he heard. And there's no wonder that, you know, there's failure within households, in marriages, and in businesses. You who are businessmen, you realize this. We realize this. I mean, many companies, such as the one Charlie Harrison and I worked in with General Electric Company, there's always attempts to, you know, find out or to communicate from upper management on down. The foreman on the line, two foremen, they could speak to one another and sort of understand. Some of it was nonverbal communication. Some of you husbands and wives, sort of, you can sort of get that way. Not all, but some. But foremen, they sort of understand one another. But when the message comes out in our days from the president, Ralph Cordner, or say the chairman of the board to Ralph Cordner and down through the ranks, by the time it got to me, although I was a member of management in the old days, if I'd have been one step lower, I would have been in a sheep pen looking out, but I was still a member of management. But by the time it got to me, you know, there was a lot lost. Huh? A lot lost. Or if I told you something here, you see, and I had you whisper it to the next one, and I said to pass it around, you know, and go through all of this, and finally come out over there, you know. Boy, I wouldn't recognize it, you know, for various reasons. And that's a plight. In businesses today, I mean, they just don't, from going from upper level of management down and from down up, we know some of the problems. We take attitude surveys and we find out some interesting things. There was a study that Nichols relates, in which a student wanted to do something on communication, and so he was down, I think, in Tulane or somewhere, and this fellow was pretty good in communication. He says, well, I'll tell you what I want you as a student to do. I've lined up many managers here of businesses, and I want you to go down there and talk to them, make notes on what they say, on their communication system within their companies, what the attitude of the people are to them and to the company. Do they understand the objectives of the company and questions like this, which he did. And sort of to a man, you know, and I can hear those fellows. I mean, we recognize it, so Charlie recognized it, you know. I mean, boy, we really got the system here, you know. I mean, we get the message across to the employees. They understand, you know, why we are here. And we put the priorities, we put these workers first on the list, you know, for benefits, and see that they're really part of the team. They're real team members, and they are loyal. They have great loyalty. And so then the professor said to the man, now, I want you to spend the next year as an assistant truck driver. And here's a stack of books, you know, you make notes on this, and here's your overalls, you know, and go to it, you know. And so he questioned, you know, talked to the people on the line sort of thing. And almost to a man, you know, they didn't understand what this was all about. They were malicious in their attacks on management. They thought that the priorities of management was completely adverse to their priorities. And so it went. The message had not gotten across. And they tried a lot of things to get around this, sort of to get the message across. They've hired sort of real fine nurses to come in to act sort of as a chaplain that had punched the ticket, you know. Be a listener, and you advertise it. And they're lined up outside the office to tell, you know, how they feel about the thing. And maybe the next week, the word goes around, she's just a stool pigeon for the general manager, and business is off. Somebody else says, well, they used a woman. You got to use a man. So they get a retired Catholic chaplain, you know. Well, the same thing happens. So we're always working on this and trying to get around it. Well, Nichols has done a lot of work on this in Minnesota, and some of you know this better than I. And he has studied this thing, and he had the same experience as the Columbia study. He couldn't believe it at first, but he He brought in people to give 10 minutes of their best lecture. And then he tested the students, and he found out essentially the same results as they did at Columbia, except he said, you don't have to wait 2 months to get a 25% retention. A couple of days will do it, you know? And so he said, well, now what are the characteristics of this bad listener? And he brought in some shrinks, and, they're the guys that, asked a lot of questions on these exams, and they were trying to find out, what is the characteristic of a bad listener so that you can get this point across. And I give some of these points, and on October 1st, I'll be facing the professional students again and telling them, here are the traits of a bad listener, like, boy, you better not do this, And I'm going to give them to you now something like I'll probably give to them. And the first characteristic of a bad listener is that he decides the subject is uninteresting and useless. And we're all often trapped at one time or another in a lecture, Or in your husband drags you off, or your wife drags you off to something, or you're trapped. And you hear the subject title, or like today, there's nothing else on now, is it? Unless you wanted to go take a sauna. And maybe there's something going on. Well, there's always something going on there. But in a way, you're sort of trapped, and some of you have heard about this character standing up here, and you say, somebody told me you got to go and listen to him, So we better find out. But this subject probably, to some of you, I've been listening all my life. What do I need that for? There is a fellow whose writings I enjoy. His name is G.K. Chesterton. And he said that there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. So you should always approach things this way and sort of accept it as a challenge. That is there something in there that I can get out of it, And so make it a challenge to see, is there something that will help me that's in there? Another thing that the bad listener does is that he criticizes the speaker. And I know they do this to me, and I gimmick this just to make the point. I only brought up one pair of socks here today, so I couldn't gimmick you this way, and I'm not sitting right, you see. I better check. Yeah, both my socks are blue. Sometimes, I have different colored socks on. In fact, not too long ago, I was asked to talk to listening to a bunch of ladies. And they didn't have a podium. So I took a chair and set it down and sat up on the back of it, like I sometimes do. And when I sat down here, And I had my pants legs up like this. I had one orange sock and one green sock. Well, they were even writing notes to one another. The first time I did this at the University of California, it was one of these sort of big auditoriums where the seats are up like this. And I was wearing a gray coat and. This will peg it because it was in the time when quite a few people wore ties. And they wore string ties. These very narrow ones. At that time, you wouldn't be caught dead with what my son calls a belly worm. You know what I mean? Great big wide ones. They're in now. Well, I saved some of these because, eventually they'll come back. Well, I had a belly warmer. And I had it on. I put it on that day, and I had it sort of tucked in my coat. And when I walked up to the podium, my coat sort of slipped back, and revealing this belly warmer. You could see him. Because they sometimes do that anyway. When I'm walking in. And I can almost hear him. I'd like to have that nose full of nickels, or look at the ears on that one, or Ben Franklin looked better in those kind of glasses than he does, it goes on like this. Or he doesn't speak very good English, and so it goes. And there is a great hazard in this, you see, because you're there not to sort of look at this thing, but you're here to kind of, you're here to listen, to see what he has to tell you. And as I tell the students, about the only part of my lecture I prepare is the first paragraph. And while they are criticizing me and, you know, going like this, they've missed the most important part of my lecture, you know, the only one I prepare. That isn't quite true, but they do miss some very important points because, you know, you get all shook up with this guy. Maybe he isn't, you know, talking the right language. And one of the things I always tell at this point is, if someone came busting in that door now and says, get the heck out of here, this rat nest's on fire, you know, you wouldn't say, couch that in better rhetoric. Huh? So don't get hung up, you know. Hear them out, and even if they don't speak very good English, listen to them. Now, another thing that we do, we get over-concerned with facts and details. Now, I talked a little bit about priorities here, and I tell this to the students, and some of you take notes, you know, and in taking notes there again, you know, take the general, look at the, try to get the structure of the thing, if there is a structure, and make certain notes. I used to sit alongside of a person when I was at the University of Washington in graduate school, and this fellow, he's a Harvard graduate. In fact, he was there. And he even used a ruler, you know, and the neatest notes you ever saw. Oh, terrific. He wasted a lot of effort keeping his notes. He only got a B out of the course. And he probably would have got an A if he had spent more time, you know, kind of listening and getting the concepts rather than making this neat outline. You know, so you can get really hung up in things like this or get concerned with detail. And I get so wheeled off when I see these reports and they're still doing it. And I tell these medical students, you know, they're always, they get seven positive cases out of 11 clinical trials and they report it as, I don't know what it is, 63.637%, you know? Instead of saying it's 7 out of 11, there's roughly 2/3, you know? And I see tables of these. In fact, I was just reviewing a paper, and I was very rough on it just the other day, you know. This whole tabular form, and he had 4 and 5 significant figures. And it has no biological significance. We're piling up, they're filling the literature with this baloney, you know. And as I tell them, and I tell you, there's nothing really significant beyond 2 significant figures, biologically speaking, really. You can say, well, maybe temperature, but not probably even there if you followed your temperature over a period of time. Calcium in the blood is thought of as nature's physiological constant. But there again, 2 significant figures will handle it well. Your body doesn't control it to any closer tolerance than that. The most significant biological figure is a woman's age. Mm-hmm. And that isn't significant beyond 2 significant figures. I say to you, you know, do you care whether they're 29 or 29.2? You don't care. Another thing that the bad listener does is to fake attention and to work, you know, to you know, and I have some of them sometimes in my classes. Boy, you know, they're like a racehorse perched at the takeoff, you know, and boy, you know, they're like this and they're tense, you know. Of course, some of them are all completely relaxed too, you know, but there is a happy medium, and they waste so much time, you know, being actors. And isn't that true in life, you know? We spend so much time trying to be somebody we are not. That's one thing I think Holden does, is to sort of remove facade, to take off our actor's uniform. It's really tough to be an actor. I remember when I went to a high school. It was a very small high school. It's called East Stanwood, you know. Now, some of you are familiar with that area. It's no longer even East Stanwood, huh? It's Stanwood now. They absorbed it. It was a very small high school, 20, I don't know, I've even forgotten. I think in my graduating class, there was 23. So, but it's a nice situation because, you know, you get into everything. You do everything. And I had to get involved in some plays. Well, I've been accused of being a ham, but it was really tough for me trying to be these various characters. It was really hard work. And one of the stories, some of you probably are getting tired of it, but it really makes this point of sort of being an actor in this thing of listening and in everyday life. And the story is told about the psychiatrist who was just ready to close shop in the evening. And he was called on by a very desperate man. And he told him his story, and he was obviously lower than a snake in a wagon track. That's as close a diagnosis as I'll give you. I know some of the jargon, but I won't give you the dimensions of this neurosis. But the psychiatrist, of course, was very, very disturbed about it because he did really realize that this person had a real problem and a deep one. And he was searching for something that will sort of tide him over. And then there was a glimmer of hope, and he says, "I'll tell you what I want you to do tonight." He says, "There's a great circus in town, and I want you to go down there and listen to it, see it, go to the various, you know, the five rings. But the most important thing I want you to see is the clown." He says, "He's the greatest clown that I've ever seen, and I want you to go and see him." There was a prolonged silence, and then the man said, "I am that clown." It's tough to be an actor. Another thing that the bad listener does is to tolerate a bad performance. Now, you don't have to start now on me, you know. But I do subscribe in part, in great part, to the C.S. Lewis philosophy that a friend of mine is no friend of mine if he doesn't care whether I lie, cheat, and steal. Why are we so hard on our children? We are hard on them because we don't want them to grow up to be clods. We love them, and so we admonish them. Sometimes not as kindly as we should, but sometimes it's probably good, as we learned earlier today, that it is well that we holler at them because they are our relatives. With your wife, she is not a relative. But it is well that we help each other. Now, you don't, it is best done. And in the circles I travel, one of the principal and cardinal rules of management is that you always criticize not in company, but in private. And it must be constructive criticism, and it can be done kindly and gently. But some of the best lessons of my life were really criticisms of my performance. And it was pretty hard to take. Or my writings or something, you know. They're like a child, you know. You go through the travail of producing this, and then you find out the child is a monster. That's hard to take. But it's better you find out than living and believing that it isn't. So you can do one another a favor. And I tell my students this. Now, I don't have to tell them much anymore. They're rather free with their criticism, you know. So we don't have as much trouble. But early on, I remember coming to the University of California, you know. And I'd sit up because we do some team teaching, and I want to know, you know, where I am in this situation, and I want to hear what's gone on before, so I'll know what I have to correct or change and where I fit into things. And I'd sit there, and I'd see stuff up on the board. I couldn't read it from where I was. Many times a speaker, you couldn't hear him, you know. Did any of the students say anything? No, they didn't. Sometimes, you know, I couldn't stand any longer, and I'd say, I can't hear you, you know, or I can't see it, you know. But now they're getting better at it, especially now that I told them they ought to do it. But as I say, they're getting better at criticism. But we can help one another, you know, and probably not while the sermon's going on. But, you know, afterwards, sometimes I write them a note. And I think one of the most useful things I do when I run a seminar, which I do periodically, on the thyroid and the parathyroid for a group of students. And in the old days, you know, what they did, and you remember some of you folks when you had to give seminars, you know, well, we'd take the SNAP course seminar. And you'd give one seminar for the quarter and that, you know, semester, and that'd be it. And the way I do it, they have to give short 10-minute summaries, because most things you ought to be able to summarize in about 10 minutes. You don't get to expound for an hour on a given subject. So they give it in 10 minutes. And then they have to appear two or three times during the quarter. And next year I'm going to put them on television so they can see how awful sometimes they are. They have to look at themselves doing it. But I give them a criticism after each one. And tell them, you know, this is how I see this, you know. And I'm sure it's somewhat traumatic the first time, but in the end, it really helps them. And I'm doing that now for, at the Padova, the International Conference on Leukemia. Fellow that graduated, and he's a great student. And he went to Klein's laboratory at Karolinska in Stockholm. It's probably the hottest tumor institute in the world, you know. He was down to Padua, and I was, just a year out, and he's giving a paper, see? Well, he didn't do too bad a paper, but it could be a lot better, you know. I'm sure, you know, he finished off, and he did, a pretty good job, you know. Well, when he gets my letter, it won't look quite so good, you know. But his next one will probably be better on account of it. And it's one of the things I told my associates at the University of California when I got there, because the laboratory I went in was in trouble. And part of the reason they were in trouble because they didn't constructively criticize one another. They didn't have a dialogue, you know. They didn't care, I guess, about the other fellow. And I told them, boy, if you do something wrong, or if I think you're not doing it right, you're going to hear from me. And when I quit doing it, you're in trouble because I've given up. And I expect the same from you to me. And you got something where, I mean, rather than me making a fool out of myself, going out here and saying something, when you hear me say something that's wrong, you better correct me. You better come in and see me. I mean, it's nice if you're sure you're ground, but, you know. So we have quite a bit of interchange on this, and it's very helpful. So we must help one another in this regard. Another thing that the bad listener does is to shun technical and painstaking listening. And what they did there was to survey what programs they listened to, you know, on television. And, you know, it was sort of like sports and Red Skelton and, I guess he isn't on anymore. They're taking off the best one, the Bear on Andy Williams' show, but, or they'd listen to the Democratic National Convention, you know. Or the Republican National Convention, you know. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, got out of the fifth grade to understand what's going on. Well, you should, if you're going to learn how to listen, you better do some painstaking listening. Not to have some of that idiotic stuff that comes out. Another thing that the bad listener does is to let emotional words throw him. I'm not going to repeat a lot of these, but for you, I imagine there's a certain hang-up. There's certain words that might be said that'll set you off, and off you go, and you lose trend of thought, and you're no longer listening. There are many things on this for me. If somebody mentions, you know, Christopher Columbus and the discovery of America, I'm lost. You know, I'm gone, because I know Leif Erikson was here 400 years or more before. You know, and I... You know, I go like this, you know. And for you, I'm sure you have sort of hang-ups like that. And you should fight this, you know, because you're still there, you know, and saying, what does that fellow have that I
should have? What should I be listening to?
Another thing that the bad listener does is to tune the speaker out. We all do this. And part of the reason is because some of the lectures aren't very good, or they speak too long. Instead of, you know, the guy talks too long and he says, "I'm sorry I talked too long, you know, but I don't have, my watch isn't working." He says, "Well, you could have used the calendar in back of you, you know." But and so it is part of the speaker's fault, but you want to concentrate on it. Now, part of the problem here is, of course, the speed at which we speak. Now, I've been speaking only at about 120 words a minute here for you. Sometimes when I do this for the students, I'll speak very rapidly. And on maybe part of this, what I'll go through from here on is that I might speak more rapidly. And in fact, if I was giving this very rapidly at about 200 words a minute, many of you would be paying much closer attention to me. You don't want to miss a word. You see, you're listening very carefully. And so that's part of the speaker's fault. But it depends a lot on the subject you're discussing. If I was giving a very technical lecture, say if I was discussing, you know, the function of the thyroid and T4 and T3 and a whole bunch of things like that, you know, and you were, you know, trying to make notes, boy, you know, you'd be lost. But on some of this, you can go much faster and you can have much closer, pay closer attention. I know myself, I tune a lot of speakers out because, you know, they're not speaking that fast. And I have to go a lot of seminars at the University of California. Some of the students are giving up there. Well, we have visitors, and most of them, you know, they don't know too much about, you know, how you really get the subject across and in an understandable way. And they have lousy charts up on the board, you know, and you can't get anything out of them, and they don't know how to make charts. They're PhDs and out of MIT, you know, but they never had the course, you know. And so I tune them out. I get much of my correspondence done going to seminars, you know. I tune them out, you know, and then I, you know, he said something, you know. And then, you know, there aren't that many ideas in an hour. That isn't true here at Holden. I can't do too much of this. In fact, you know, this morning, I'm still preparing my thing for Vespers tonight, you know. And I don't know if you saw me, I was up in the... I'm kind of infamous for this because I'm usually always up on the loft in Koinonia, you know, and I always have my stuff all laid out there. I usually sit by the window so I can also catch a bird if it's going by, you know, but, and I was still working, you know, on this mystery thing today, but I didn't really get anything done on it because I was so interested in what the... Carol and Al were saying, so that was good, you know, but it didn't help the thing on mystery. Now, what does a good listener do? Well, one of the things he tries to do is, and that Nickel says, is anticipate the next point. I don't know about this, but I know two other things that are very important, and I've made some of these points as I've gone through, but one of the things, you try to see if there's a structure to this and try to fit in. On many subjects, you have a certain structure, and you say, well, where does that change the structure and or the mechanism that we're discussing? And so you have this structure, you try to identify the building blocks. And the other thing is that you recapitulate. And you could have done that today, because this is very important, because if I was speaking very rapidly, you couldn't have recapitulated too much. But I was going slow enough so that you could have recapitulated. So that as I went through the points, eight or nine of them, you could have been, you know, going back, you know, and by the time you got through here, you could have written them all down without looking at your paper, if you would have recapitulated. See? That's a very important point. And so as you listen, you should recapitulate the important point to what was said. All right, that's page one. Now, I've already hit some of the importance of this in our everyday life. And it's really, you know, sad. And there was a book, The Listener, in which the main character in it is contracted for a large building. And on the outside it says, "The Man Who Listens." And at the dedication, he said in part that, you know, it's a real sad thing today that nobody listens to anyone else. You know, even if you're sick or lonely or dying, nobody listens. You're bewildered, frightened, lost, bereaved, alone. Nobody listens. Even the clergy who are harassed and they too don't have any time to listen. And he says, our life doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anybody else, not even those who love you and would die for you. He says, your parents, your children, your friends, they have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? Whose fault is it? I don't know. But there just doesn't seem to be any talk. And as I said, this is from the listener, and it's fiction. But you don't have to go to fiction to hear this. You can read the newspapers, or you can read this letter that I have here from Creative Brooding, and it's a real letter. Some of you have heard it before, but it makes the point, and if you haven't heard it, you listen and probably never forget it. Dear folks, thank you for everything, but I'm going to Chicago and I'm going to start some kind of new life. You asked me why I did those things and why I gave you so much trouble, and the answer is easy for me to give you, but I'm wondering if you will understand. Remember when I was about 6 or 7 and I used to want you to listen to me? I remember all the nice things you gave me for Christmas and my birthday, and I was really happy with the things about a week at a time when I got them, but the rest of the time and during the year, I really didn't want presents. I just wanted all the time for you to listen to me like I was somebody who felt things too. Because I remember when I was young, I felt things, but you said that you were too busy. Mom, you're a wonderful cook, and you had everything so clean, and you were tired too much from doing the things that made you so busy. But you know something, Mom? I would have liked crackers and peanut butter just as well if you'd only sat down for a while during the day and said to me, tell me about it so that I may help you understand. And when Donna came, I couldn't understand why everyone made so much fuss, because I didn't think it was my fault that her hair is curly and her skin so white, and she doesn't have to wear glasses with such thick lenses. Her grades were better too, weren't they? If Donna ever has any children, I hope you will tell her just to pay some attention to the one who doesn't smile very much, because that one will really be crying inside. And when she's about to bake 6 dozen cookies, to make sure first that the kids don't want to tell her about a dream or a hope or something, because thoughts are important too to small kids, even though they don't have so many words to use when they tell you about what they have inside of them. I think that all the kids who are doing so many things that grown-ups are tearing out their hair worrying about are really looking for somebody that will have time to listen a few minutes and who really and truly will treat them as they would a grown-up who might be useful to them, you know, and polite to them. If you folks had ever said to me, pardon me, when you interrupted me, I'd have dropped dead. If anybody asked you where I am, tell them I've gone looking for somebody with time, because I've got a lot of things I want to talk about. Love to all, your son. Now this is submitted without comment because it speaks for itself. Now God has had a lot of trouble with this too. God and the prophets. They said, you have ears, but you do not hear. And as important as these things are that I've told you, it is more important to listen to God. That is priority one. And I assume that there's a good deal of concern with this, because there are about 1,200 references to listening and hearing in the Bible. Now, where do we hear God? And as I do in most of my talks on theological subjects, I quote from some of Al Rognitz. You hear God, you either hear him everywhere or you hear him nowhere. To hear him, you must hear him in Jesus Christ. First, it's a local voice before it becomes a universal one. You hear him in one place before you hear him in every place. God remains a vague, mysterious, and hidden power, and therefore not the great God of creation, until you have him in the person of someone who walked among us. The roar of a cascading stream remains just a roar. The rustle of the wind in the trees remains but a rustle. Nature speaks only her own language unless you have heard God speak to you through Jesus Christ. Happy is the man, the woman, the child who has tuned his ear to the living word. Then everything begins to speak of God. Knowing his love, you know his majesty. Know his love, you can see his handiwork in the intricate and complex designs of all creation. But there's a risk in listening to him, for then you risk hearing other voices, the groans, the cries of the unfortunate of the world, people with problems even as close as your own house and in the house next door. There are many stories and many statements that you can listen to that are undisturbing. They leave us in peace. Trees are green, the sky is blue, and H2O is water. Now, when you hear that, it doesn't really send you. When I hear these, my life remains unchanged. There are other things that we can hear that are most disturbing to us. And I'll give you a personal example here to bring out the point. On a certain night, when my wife said to me, "Will you marry me?" You know, I could not hear that and remain passive. For it called for a decision. I couldn't go home and, you know, have a glass of buttermilk and sack out and go to sleep, you know. It called for a rejection or to give my heart to her. It might have been the other way around, but, you know, with time you kind of get this thing right. But God's call to us is like that. The old story of Jesus and his love is like that. We cannot listen to the word that Jesus bar Joseph, the carpenter of Nazareth, was in fact and in truth, and in the most exact and literal sense of the word, the God by whom all things were made. He was not merely a man so good as to be like God. He was God. We cannot face the cross where Christ died to forgive our sins so that we may obtain sonship. We cannot hear this story and do nothing. We must either escape the tormenting reach of the story by rejecting him or be caught up in the wonderment of it all, in the sheer wonder of his love. He that has ears to hear, let him hear. For the Lord is near to all who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth. Amen. Amen.